This is a podcast from ABC Overnights. Here's Trevor Chappell.
Nathan Abrams is a professor of film at Bangor University in Wales, also the author of Stanley Kubrick, New York Jewish Intellectual and Eyes Wide Shut, Stanley Kubrick and the Making of His Final Film. Nathan, hello.
Hi, good evening.
Hey, Nathan, firstly, how significant is the music and the selection of music for Stanley Kubrick films?
Oh, really significant. I mean, you can't really talk about Kubrick without talking about music, particularly in his later films from 2001 onwards. I mean, just having a classical score and a modernist score for a sci-fi movie was kind of revolutionary in 68 and has kind of set the benchmark ever since. So now if you play the Blue Danube to a child, they'll go, oh, well, that's space music.
How does he go about making those selections? Does he spend a long time listening and trying to work out what he wants to use? Does he take the images that he is choosing and then want to take the music to that? How does he make those selections?
It's all of what you've said. I mean, he does spend a long time thinking about it, going through all the options. He often hires arrangers and composers to come up with parts of or all of the score. And then out of that kind of selection, the final thing emerges, and it might only emerge in the editing room. So, he'll also play temp tracks during production. That might end up being the final track. So out of those different processes of experimentation, he finally comes up with the final score, and it might only emerge in the editing room, in which case the images might be edited to match the music and vice versa.
Does he also like to muck around with the music and the images to have opposites running at the same time? And I think like in Clockwork Orange, with the use of beautiful music placed with violent images.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, there is that kind of counterpoint between what we hear and what we see, and a comment's being made about that, you know, no matter how cultured you are, you can still be prone to violence. But yeah, that's definitely the case. I mean, think of the end of Dr. Strangelove, We'll Meet Again, as the atom bomb's going off. So there is an irony that Kubrick had a wicked sense of humour that kind of creeps in through those counterpoints.
Does he also do counterpoint just in the images themselves, in that he can have beautiful images that are quite stark in the way that they're portrayed? I'm thinking about in The Shining, with those beautiful images of the child running through the maze, but which is him actually being chased, and that there's a violent thing associated with that as well. But the imagery is quite beautiful.
Yeah, I think, you know, throughout his films, there's beautiful imagery, even if what we're seeing is not a beautiful thing. You know, think Full Metal Jacket or... for me, Barry Lyndon would be the kind of go-to film to answer this question, because it's a beautiful-looking, sort of very painterly composition, but it's very superficial and deliberately so, to kind of show that this is a superficial society and to give his view of it. And I think what's smart about what he does is he's communicating information through these choices that aren't just aesthetic choices.
Does his photography and his background in photography assist him in that, in the way that he actually frames his shots?
Oh, definitely. I mean, Kubrick learned a lot as an apprentice and a professional photographer. He learned to work with other people because a lot of the stories for Look, he worked with a writer. So he learned early collaboration with others. He learned to frame, compose his shots, lighting. That was his speciality. And he carried that over with him, particularly once he got over those early films into his mature career. Most people who work with him say, look, he knew all the roles on the set and could do them. So you had to be on top of your game because he would check. He didn't necessarily do it all himself, but he would check as he got older. And a lot of this was drawn from his photography background.
Let's go back and take a look at that. How was it that he got involved in photography early?
Well, his dad gave him a camera when he was, I think, 13, and he started to muck about with it with his neighbourhood chums and develop his own pictures. And he was a high school photographer for the Taft magazine, and at summer camps during the holidays. And he tried his luck. He sent pictures in. to Look magazine and other places, and finally he got accepted. And he kept sending pictures, and that parlayed into a part-time job, and then eventually when he graduated high school, he took a full-time job there. So it's really something he carries with him throughout his childhood, up until until he gets that job at Look. The other thing I wanted to add, sorry, to the previous question that you asked, is you also learn how to sort of manipulate and stage. Big part of photography is staging things just how you want. So you're not quite taking a photo of the reality, you're taking a photo of the reality, as Kubrick put it. And I think he took that manipulation and staging all through his career.
He was a very good chess player too, which I was interested to read, Nathan.
Yeah, about the same time as his dad gave him a camera, his dad taught him chess. He would hustle playing chess when he was poorer, in the 50s, and arguably took a kind of chess sensibility with him throughout his career in sort of two senses. One, how to play the long game, how to think through, in long terms, how to do a shoot. But secondly, the kind of psychological manipulation that comes with any game. You want to psych out your opponent, right? And Kubrick was famed for playing psychological mind games with actors in particular to get the performances he wanted. And then there's the simple things like you see images of him on set playing chess with George C. Scott and Dr. Strangelove. He played chess with Shelley Duvall throughout The Shining. We also see chess motifs in his films too.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I mean, there's direct allusions in, say, Lolita, where Charlotte Hayes says to Humbert, "Oh, you're going to take my queen," and he says, "Well, that is my intention." And there's the chess game in 2001. I mean, wars are all chess games. There's checkerboards on the floor. There's sort of characters that look like pawns, that sort of thing. So photography's in his films as well. Photographers and journalists appear in his films too, so that's another thing to add.
When you take a look at that, where you talk about how he looked at making films in the long game, as with chess as well, is that one of the reasons that when you take a look at his filmography, he didn't make many films and over a long period of time. However, he made very good films, so he took... I understand that other directors take filmmaking very seriously, but he wanted to take time to make very good works of art.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at his career as a whole, there seems to be huge gaps. So take between Full Metal Jacket and Eyes Wide Shut, it's 1987, 1999, so it's 12 years. It didn't take him 12 years to make Eyes Wide Shut. It took him 12 years to decide, well, less than 12 years, 12 years to decide and make Eyes Wide Shut. When he wanted to make a film, it was relatively quick. I mean, he's no Spielberg. He's not doing two films a year, or other directors. But if you think Spartacus 1960, Lolita 62, Strangelove 64, that's a film every 2 years. Then 4 years to make 2001, because really he was like inventing special effects there for science fiction. Then only sort of 3 years or 2 years to make Clockwork Orange. Barry Lyndon took longer because he tried to make Napoleon and failed. And I think what we need to account for is he's not spending all that time trying to make a new film. He spent that time trying to make a film, inevitably fails, and then ends up making the film that comes out, if that makes sense.
George joins us. Hello, George.
G'day, gentlemen. Stanley Kubrick is just an amazing filmmaker. I mean, he just spent so much time, particularly in his later career, sort of researching and developing films and creating innovations in special effects and sound design. But what was interesting to me first, and I think a lot of people I know, everybody thought he was a British filmmaker until you realise he started off in America and then moved over to England for the majority of his life, because his sensibilities, in a way, seem to be a lot more in the British sense, particularly with his sense of satire and so forth. But I've seen his first film, which was only released just some years ago, Fear and Desire, which is a kind of a war allegory about, the futility of war. And you could see the early kind of themes in terms of great social issues coming through. But what I wanted to ask your guest about, Trev, in particular, two things. Firstly, there was an original score written for 2001: A Space Odyssey, because the music, that classical music that he wrote, was the stuff that he put there to edit to temporarily, you know, often called a temp track, and he kind of fell in love with it. And the score that was actually composed for it by a composer, famous Hollywood composer called Alex North, was never actually used in the film. So I was just wondering, I know it's been released because I've got a copy of it on record, but I wonder if anybody has ever tried to marry it up to see what it would look like, on the film itself. And the second question is about Kubrick's wife, because you never hear much about her, but she was a big influence on him, Christiana, his third wife. She was a German actress that he met on the set of Paths of Glory, his early anti-war film, and they were together for the rest of his life. And she became a great painter, and a lot of her paintings are featured in the sets of Kubrick's films. I know in Eyes Wide Shut, most of the paintings on the wall of Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman's apartment are hers, and I think Sidney Pollack, who also featured it, his apartment also featured, and I think also in Clockwork Orange and some of his other works. So I just wondered if you could comment on how much influence she had on him.
Nathan?
Yeah, definitely. Just to answer the first question quickly, I'm sure someone has paired them up, so probably you have to surf the internet for that. I haven't seen it myself. I'm just more interested in what he did as opposed to the alternatives. But you're right in everything you said. Yeah, definitely. I think it's important to refer to all three of Kubrick's wives and the influence they had on his career. So just to talk briefly about that, his first wife, Toba Metz, who is his high school sweetheart, played a role as he was a photographer and moving into films. And you can see her in Fear and Desire as one of the fisherwomen. And she played a role behind the scenes. They split up during the kind of making of that film. And he then met and moved in with Ruth Sobotka, and she played probably a very key role in his intellectual, artistic, cultural development, introducing him to, like, Schnitzler, for example, introducing him to Schnitzler, the subject of his final film. And she also worked on The Killing and The Killer's Kiss as well. And she was in Killer's Kiss. And then in 1957, he meets and marries Christian Harlan. And, you know, they were together for four decades, and not only were her paintings, I mean, he would talk to her when she was painting and painting him and consult with her. Some of the musical choices might have been her suggestions, and also their daughters were involved in the filmmaking process, particularly Vivian. I think one can't reckon on Kubrick without thinking about all three of his wives and all three of his daughters. You know, it's wrong to think of him as that sole, lonely, creative artist, you know, like a painter. He was very much wedded, well, literally, you know, wedded to his family, who were part of his creative process.
Nathan, that move from photography into film, did that come from him photography, like being involved in photography with boxing?
Yeah, I think what motivated is he realised he could make a film and probably make more money from doing it. And there was probably only a certain amount of freedom you could have as a photographer and possibly only a certain amount of money you could make. He watched, you know, watched a lot of films, decided he could do it himself, hired a camera, got and used one of his early photo stories, The Prize Fighter, and used that basically as his storyboard and adapted it then into a longer short film. Yeah, and he was interested in boxers, definitely in both. He enjoyed the sport, I mean, watching it, and he'd photographed boxers as part of Look magazine, but it provided a ready-made kind of pitch and screenplay for the series that he was going for when he decided to move into motion pictures.
So how significant was that move into motion pictures, and how did he get the money to be able to do that?
I think it's significant from the point of view as it made him Stanley Kubrick, you know, director that we know today. But those early pictures tend to be overlooked. And as your previous caller said, you know, Fear and Desire has only been recently rediscovered. He sold the film to, I think it was Pathé, get the capital from friends and family, and then recoup it by selling the film and then move on to the next one. We weren't talking a massive budget back then. And when he went out to make his first feature film, he got the money mainly from his uncle, his mum's brother, who was quite a wealthy pharmacist in Los Angeles.
So was it, because we recognise him as wanting to have, and you said before, a finger in every pie, whether or not he did it himself, but he would also want to be involved in what other people were doing and keeping an eye on them. Is that because when he was first making films, he was literally doing everything?
Yeah, possibly. I mean, it's probably a feature of his personality. he had to do everything pretty much apart from act on his first movie. I think he got more kind of obsessive, as it were, once James Harris, his partner from 1955 to sort of 1962, left. So Harris did a lot of the production side of things, raising the money, doing the deals, signing the contracts. I mean, obviously Kubrick signed the contracts, but the background work, and then Kubrick had to take that all over. And probably didn't trust anyone else to do it, apart from his brother-in-law, who became his money man and oversaw kind of a lot of the production details, making sure everything was on schedule from Clockwork Orange onwards. But I think it's also a feature of his sort of obsessive personality that I think he needed to keep an eye on everything.
Was Spartacus the film that introduced him to Hollywood and introduced him to big budgets and the making of big films?
Remember, Kubrick had moved to Hollywood in 55 to make The Killing, and he then had an abortive deal with MGM in 56 to make a film called Burning Secret, the script of which was only just recently rediscovered. So, then he had a series of failed attempts. One-Eyed Jack was probably the most famous between then and Spartacus. So he already was familiar with Hollywood from 55 to 59. But what you're right is 59 introduced him to big-budget Hollywood, and both made him and sort of at the same time decided that he's never going to stay in Hollywood anymore, hence why he's considered British.
So what was it that happened with Spartacus that made him draw that decision?
Well, I mean, I think he hated L.A. He didn't enjoy it there. Sort of everyone knew your business. Where's the next place to go to make films? Well, just outside London. And you're not going to run into any Hollywood executives. It's just simply the fact of life. You're not going to see them in restaurants or out the street or whatnot. So he wanted that distance. He perhaps would have gone to New York. I mean, he did go back to New York. But New York was changing. It wasn't the New York he grew up in. Christiane didn't like it. And so England provided that perfect family home with excellent production facilities, privacy from the Hollywood studios. And possibly the final straw for him was that the studio had Final Cut over Spartacus and kind of botched it in 1960. And if you see him in interviews, at first he's like, well, it's my film. And then he's like, well, it's a pretty dumb story. So, you know, he kind of claims it and then dials back on that. And I think it was that Hollywood interference. He didn't want that studio interference, to botch the Final Cut.
That move to England and to London, because that was a really good time for British film as well. So it was a good time to actually be involved in British cinema.
Yeah, I mean, there were these financial incentives, the E.D. Levy. You see this after World War II, an attempt to build up domestic film industries. There's tax incentives for foreign filmmakers to make their films there. As I said, you've got excellent production facilities, all the studios that were there then, and technical know-how, you know, first-rate cinematographers and other creative personnel, and just, you know, superb actors. And what Kubrick learned on Spartacus, and I think Spartacus needs to be understood much more widely, how important it was to Kubrick's career, was he worked with these great British actors, you know, Laurence Olivier, Charles Laughton, Peter Ustinov, and he learned just how professional they were. And there's one little anecdote I like. You know, Kubrick, young kid, parachuted into this set, hadn't done any pre-production. Kirk Douglas had fired the previous director, and he heard all the actors muttering behind his back. And anytime he drew close, they stopped muttering. And he thought at first they were talking about him, and then eventually he figured out they were practicing their lines. And these theatre actors knew their lines, they were prepared, and he got a real taste for it. The other thing in Britain is you had all the small screen actors, you know, Peter Sellers being the notable example. But if you look at a lot of the actors that he's using in his films, not the principals, Peter Sellers being the exception, they're appearing on British TV. So you really, you have everything that you need right there.
Because you talk about him working with theatre actors and their ability to learn lines. Did he have those expectations and very high expectations from that he expected actors to be able to do that, have the same process?
Yeah, come to set prepared, know your lines, you know, just know your lines inside and out. That way, there's always this rumour about how many takes he does, 128 takes. And, you know, half of them because an actor's fluffing their lines or something technical goes wrong, right? You know, there's a boom in the shot or something that shouldn't be there. But if your actor hasn't got the lines right, then, you know, that's the... You need to get all the lines right before you can pick amongst the takes. And then what he wanted was something that wasn't a stylized performance. You know, he was aiming for something where he saw maybe something come out that you couldn't prepare or plan for or practice. But you needed to know your lines in order to get there. Because if you keep fluffing them, then you can't get to that place.
So it's not as if he was a really hard-nosed director. He just had expectations that were really quite realistic.
Yeah, I mean, that's a debate on Kubrick, isn't it? I think he was hard-nosed. I mean, he demanded 100% commitment from his workers for his project, even if he wasn't paying them like he was being paid. And there was no time of day for him. He lived on New York time, and people would get phone calls on all hours. So, I think somewhere between the two, you know, he's a hard-nosed director, with reasonable expectations, but at times I think those expectations became unreasonable.
Sid joins us. Hello, Sid.
G'day, mate. How you going?
Good.
I don't know if people realise the soundtrack, Thusbrach, Zarathustra and Daisy Bells from Space Odyssey. Elvis Presley used the Zarathustra on his entrance into his act when he came on stage, because I saw him in Vegas, and Daisy Bells, when Howard was singing to on his own, was the first computer music with voice in any film ever. It was the first time a computer had used the human voice.
Look, thank you, because there are all these little facts. That's one of the wonderful things about Kubrick's films, Nathan, is that there are all of these little pearls that come out of them.
Oh, definitely. I mean, I think there's two things. There's one, there's all the pearls that come out of them and things, you know, I'm writing a biography at the moment and, you know, we're learning loads. I'm co-writing it with Robert Colker, who I wrote my previous book with. And we're learning loads of little nuggets here. But the other thing is how they then enter popular culture, like the caller alluded to. They become, you know, nowadays it's memes and GIFs and whatnot, but they become part of the popular culture. So the stuff those of us who didn't see the original films have grown up with, we might not even know where they're from. Like, we might not have even seen the film, but we know the references, especially if you watch The Simpsons or something. So it's kind of the two-way thing that I like about this as well. And now, you know, when Trump went to meet North Korean leader, you know, Dr. Strangelove memes were popping up. It's sort of the enduring relevance as well of a lot of what Kubrick had to say that I also like.
Was he given freedom in England that you don't think he would have got in America for making films like Lolita?
That's possibly another reason why he went over to England, but he still had to contend with British censorship rules, which he did. There is an argument he had more freedom, but I suppose cinema was still, you know, not as free then anywhere as we might consider it now.
Because that was a very confronting film to make for that time, and probably would be today as well. How was that film received when it was first distributed and first released?
It's really interesting reading the reviews and subsequent revelations in light of today's, in light of today's eyes. I think, you know, reading, so James Harris, his producer, had a relationship with Sue Lyon, who played Lolita after the film came out. And, you know, it wouldn't be reported on, it was kind of reported in a nod and a wink way that, but back then, you know, obviously we weren't reporting it in the same way. And I think that also colored the reviews. The reviews, I think, more concerned with whether he'd adapted Nabokov's novel well than with the actual subject matter in a way that's probably we don't understand now.
Yeah.
You know, Pauline Kael came out with quite, I think if she wrote it today, I don't know if she would still keep her job.
Hello, Ted.
Oh, hi, gents. I think that Kubrick, for me, was such a genius that he could have played 3D chess, to be honest. But the epitome for me, well, he had several layers in many of his films, especially leading towards the end. And the epitome for me is The Shining. There's actually a documentary on The Shining. I think it's called Room 238 or something like that, which is a reference to that mysterious room, where they canvass, I think, about half a dozen different scenarios that could possibly fit in. And I actually think that they all probably fit in, and they intended them all to fit in, including the Indian Massacre and, most controversially, the purported admission that he filmed the moon landing.
Nathan?
Well, you know, the it's Room 237. Yeah, I'm well familiar with the documentary. I mean, you know the classic story that Kubrick was asked to film the moon landings, but being the perfectionist, he insisted on doing it on location.
And that choice of films that he makes, Nathan, because The Shining, a horror film, you've got Barry Lyndon, which is a period piece. Did he deliberately want to do different genres of film, or is it that he found different things interesting?
I think it's the latter. I mean, he set himself a challenge with every new film. I think that's the interesting thing about Kubrick, is he set the bar high. He didn't repeat himself and all right, some argue that he did, but he made two film noirs back to back in The Killer's Kiss and The Killing. But in his mature career, he didn't repeat himself, and he set the bar high. So, you know, had to recreate Space in 2001, and then Clockwork Orange with its editing, and he did it with Radio Mikes, and quite a challenging movie for 71, and Barry Lyndon, a period piece, The Shining. And then recreating Vietnam in London, you know, he didn't make things easy for himself. For me, what motivated his choice of films, or should I say for him, was, you know, there's what's going on in Hollywood at the time. So he is a commercial film director. He wants to make a profit on his movies. So he's got an eye on that. Although, you know, 2001 is a bolt from the blue, in that people thought he was kidding when he was going to make science fiction in 64. You know, 71, we can see that Clockwork Orange fits into a period of violent movies like Straw Dogs or I Spit in Your Grave, but also musicals. I think Clockwork Orange is a musical. So you've got Funny Girl, which Kubrick liked, and The Producers, which is probably influenced by Strangelove, and then and Oliver, which won the Oscar in 68, and then also Fiddler on the Roof. So it does fit into the era. And then he wanted to make the Napoleon epic at a time when other people were making them, but they flopped. So he made Barry Lyndon, and that was probably the film that was most out of its time. And then he wanted a commercial hit. And what was the big genre from Rosemary's Baby through the 70s is horror. And so Shining kind of caps a decade, 12 years of horror, and is the commercial hit he wanted. And Platoon comes shortly out after, Full Metal Jacket comes out shortly after Platoon, which was an error. But it shows that there's a sort of genre cycle going on in Hollywood. But also, I think Kubrick was interested in certain things at certain times. Certain themes he carried with him throughout his careers, and others piqued his interest at a particular point, and he came to it quickly. So Clockwork Orange, he came to that quickly, and it was a relatively quick film for him. And then Full Metal Jacket. He wanted to do a war movie in 1980 after The Shining, but he didn't know what. And then once he alighted on the right text, which is The Short Timers, he knew that's what he wanted to make a film about, Vietnam War.
Ian, hello.
Good morning, Trevor. A couple of snippets for you and a question. You mentioned chess before. He's a master, yes, and he used his talent in the bomb one. Name slips me.
Strangelove.
Yeah, yeah.
Strangelove, yeah. To manipulate George C. Scott into playing the over-the-top. It made him take three different takes, one fairly straight, one a bit mad, one completely over-the-top. George Scott hated it, didn't want to do the mad one. And George Scott just was a good chess player, but Kubrick just thrashed him and just got his respect and said, right, you're doing it this way, and he did. Mm-hmm. And another point on his photographic knowledge, he... For instance, he used super slow NASA designed Zeiss 0.7 super fast lenses made for the moon landing in the Barry Lyndon, and Eyes Wide Shut again. And it's a camera lens you're looking down when you look at the eye of Hal. He did push to film stock like crazy to get those effects, but he did it under natural candlelight in Eyes Wide Shut, Barry Lyndon, and a bit of Eyes Wide Shut.
And let me just go back to Nathan on those things and just his technical ability coming from photography, just in simple things like lenses and his use of camera and also shots, Nathan?
Yeah, the thing I like about Kubrick is probably can be boiled down into two things. Is one, his films are intellectual. We'll talk about that in a bit. But there's also, he pushes the envelope technically or technologically, and your callers alluded to that in terms of particularly 2001 onwards. There's usually some technical achievement that occurs in the film that then sets the benchmark for other filmmakers, whether that's the use of the Zeiss lenses for candlelight, the push processing for Eyes Wide Shut, Steadicam in The Shining, recreating Vietnam in London, which is a pretty big technical achievement. You forget it's a cold winter London that he's filming Southeast Asia. So, yeah, I 100% agree with your caller that there's always some technical achievement that then others are now looking to and using because he did it. And now there's probably a button on their computer to recreate it.
Nathan, you talk about the intellectual process or what's seen as the intellectuality, for want of a better word, of his films. There's an art being able to combine that with commercial success and films that people want to see. And you just pointed out that he wanted people to see his films, but he also wanted them to be smart.
Yeah, I can't think of any other filmmakers that have combined consistently a film of ideas and depth with that kind of technical virtuosity and commercialism. And one of the things that I particularly like is we held a 50th anniversary of 2001 in 2018 here in Bangor, North Wales. And, the opening point was, how many other films are we discussing in this level of detail 50 years later? And I bet we still will be discussing it in 50 years. You know, what does this film mean? What questions is it asking? It asks the big questions and new generations reinterpret it anew. But this is sort of predicated on the fact that he did do so much research and reading for his films, not just to get it so it looked right. You know, the story is with the B-52 cockpit, he got it, had to go consult magazines because the US Air Force wouldn't let him near one. But when they looked round it, they went white because they thought their secrets had been stolen. So it isn't just the look of his films that are so good. He read the stuff and he put the ideas in the films. You know, he was reading Freud and Bruno Bettelheim and The Uncanny and other texts, Gothic literature, working with a professor of Gothic literature to write the screenplay, Diane Johnson, for The Shining, right? So there's this sort of intellectual depth that underpins the very making of the film. I'm not sure I 100% agree with your caller who said that those theories about Room 237 are probably all deliberate on Kubrick's. But what I will say is, he made text that sustained a level of interpretation, some of it bonkers, but not many other filmmakers are able to create those texts where we can have all those interpretations, even if they are bonkers.
Well, just before we go to the news, I wanted to talk about his relationship with actors because it's spoken about a lot and that some people found him very difficult to work with. Other people said that they're inspired by him. How significant and important was that for him as a director to direct?
You mean the actors? Mm. That was the hardest part for him. I think the bit, and I've just sort of learned this, that the bit he really probably, other than he said, I'm not a writer, was directing actors. And he sought advice on that. One person he sought advice from was this chap called Herbert Wise, a British director. He watched a film of his called The Siege of Manchester in 65 and summoned him to the studio and said, can you help? How do you get such wonderful performances? And I think that's why the relationships between Kubrick and actors were strained. Because if they weren't giving him what he wanted, he perhaps didn't know how to coax that performance from them. And you could probably see the frustration on both sides. Him, he's not getting what he wanted, and then because they're having to do like 120 takes of walking through a door or switching on a light, and that went right through his career. He never solved it by the end. Although when you watch Eyes Wide Shut, I think the performance that I think Tom Cruise gave a fantastic performance. Nicole Kidman's obviously excellent. So I'm speaking to an Australian audience, and but Sidney Pollack, particularly in the scene with the billiards. I just think, you know, you just look at him and his body language and you're like, you sort of forget he's acting. But he's just so naturalistic, the performance. So he got the results he wanted, but I don't think he kind of knew how to get there.
Nathan, why didn't he ever receive an Academy Award?
You'll have to ask the Academy that, because it's probably more to do with politics with a small p than it is to do with any artistic merit. But it is a glaring hole. My dogs disapprove. It is a glaring hole in his career. And it's very appropriate that my dogs are chiming in, because Kubrick's dogs and cats were a big part of his life and filmmaking process.
I'll tell you what, he's got a fine bark. What's his name?
Oh, there's two there. We got Moose and Pepper.
As you deal with the dogs, thank you very much for joining us on the program this morning.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it. Thank you.
See you later, Nathan. Nathan Abrams, who's a professor in film at Bangor University in Wales and author of Stanley Kubrick, the New York Jewish intellectual, and also Eyes Wide Shut, Stanley Kubrick and the making of his final film. You're listening to Overnights on ABC Radio with Trevor Chappell.